NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power by the hour program for owners of piston powered aircraft that can stabilize the long term cost of owning your airplane.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Always good to be with you. It is the start of a new year. We're into 2025, and we are starting our accident dissection of a celebrity accident in this case. Todd's done some good work in hunting it down, and it happens to be a famous race car driver, or now ex-race car driver, Dale Earnhardt Jr. And this was one of those accidents, gentlemen, that you have two professional pilots, and not only are they supposed to be professional pilots, one is the director of flight operations for this particular operation. And you have two pilots trying to make decisions at the very last minutes of this flight that should have been made well before they ever got into this situation. And I'm going to let Todd describe this very short 18-minute flight before we get into talking about the shoulds and the shouldn'ts of what took place.
Well, very well. This was an accident that took place on August 15, 2019 in Elizabethtown, Tennessee. This was a Citation Latitude, which had on board Dale Earnhardt and apparently his wife and child and a dog, as well as two pilots. It had taken off from Statesville, North Carolina, and it was roughly a 70 nautical mile flight, which is about the distance from Newark Airport to Philadelphia Airport. Relatively short distance as jets fly, because it was less than a 20-minute flight from takeoff to landing. And the landing was problematic. The aircraft was in an unstabilized approach, landed fairly hard, bounced several times, and after the third bounce, the fourth touchdown on the runway, right main landing gear collapse, the aircraft slid off the runway, ran across a ditch, ran through a chain link fence, and caught fire. Fortunately, through the efforts of both the flight crew members and Dale Earnhardt, they were able to get the main passenger entry door open, and they were all able to escape with only minor injuries to the passengers. But the story started a long time before this, because we had a very interesting combination of pilots on board this aircraft, with an interesting dynamic between them. The pilot in command was the pilot of the aircraft, was flying this particular leg. The co-pilot happened to be the director of flight operations and the direct manager of the pilot in command. Yet there was, how should I say it, interesting decision-making going on throughout the latter part of this flight. And Greg, I'd like you to go into detail on that one, and without too many expletives, please.
Okay, I'll just start with, this was an SS, period. And our audience can figure out what I'm saying. These are short flights, 18-minute flights. They took off, they climbed to 12,500 feet, and basically weren't there very long before they had to start down and get into this approach configuration. The dynamic started well before this flight ever left the ground out of Statesville. And again, it takes a lot of pre-planning. It is a short flight. You're going to be up and down. The workload's going to be high. There has to be good crew coordination. But you brought up an interesting point, because reading the report and going through the cockpit voice recorder transcript and the summary by the NTSB, not only was the airplane, you know, not going very fast as far as airspeed is concerned, they got into high rates of descent, very close to the ground, and they also engaged in a conversation. The PIC is discussing with the director of flight operations, who was acting as the co-pilot, a variety of different things. The co-pilot, this is the director of flight operations, then asks the pilot in command, when they're at about 500 feet above the ground, do you think we should go around? To which the pilot in command says, nope, and continues this unstabilized, ridiculously fast approach and then touchdown that results in not one, not two, not three, but four bounces in the landing. And of course, while this is all taking place, they're trying to do a variety of different things. One, they're trying to deploy the thrust reversers, the speed brakes, which should have been deployed first on touchdown, never came up because they didn't deploy them on the first touchdown. And then when they did decide that maybe they should try to execute a go around, they were in between the bounce oscillations. So of course, weight off wheels, the airplane's now thinking, well, wait a minute here. Yeah, we're airborne, but the thrust reversers aren't stowed and we're not going anywhere because the pilot tried to advance the throttles for the go around and the airplane said, no, the thrust reversers aren't stowed. So I'm going to not allow you to fly the airplane. Of course, the airplane comes back down to the runway and bad things start to happen so that they've lost control. And as Todd said, the airplane goes sliding off the runway through a chain link fence, rolls on its side, catches fire. The sad thing is that the airplane, the way it rolled, rolled to the left when it came to rest, which prevented the opening of the main entrance door. It was basically cracked if you look at photographs, and we'll have those on the website. But when you look at the door, they couldn't get the door open more than maybe 12 inches, 13 inches. So it wasn't usable for the evacuation. Now, there was discussion in the NTSB report about trying to use the emergency exit in the aft right side just ahead of the right engine. Why they couldn't get that one open, since it was on the high side of the aircraft, it could have been because the fuselage was twisted. There was damage to it. Nobody really knows, and the report didn't go into a lot of detail. But the fact is that everybody was able to escape from this burning wreckage. The question, and of course the NTSB did get into some details, but the probable cause was very scant when it comes to a whole sequence of events. They gave me the aftermath. They gave us the result that the pilots, yeah, they had an unstabilized approach. They screwed up the landing. They tried to do a variety of things and bad things happened. But there's a lot of questions, John and Todd, that we just discussed off air that aren't answered in this report or any of the supporting documents. It's disheartening when, you know, again, you have not only a celebrity, but if this happened to somebody that was a non-celebrity, these investigations warrant in-depth discussion about where this airplane accident really started. It wasn't on the approach, and it was definitely not on the landing. It was before this airplane ever left the ground. What was the pre-planning like? Because, John, you preach it all the time at the end of our shows. Was there a sense of urgency? This is an 18-minute flight, so, you know, you're constantly, as pilots, doing something. Because you're on the climb, you're at a level, now you're already planning for the descent and the approach. They got into high rates of descent, they're unstabilized. The question is, why didn't they follow not only their in-house procedures, but why didn't they follow the procedures in the flight manual? And oh, by the way, why didn't they follow any of the procedures that they were trained to follow for flying this type of aircraft? I mean, there's a lot of questions that don't seem to have answers in this particular report.
And one of the things about this flight, it was a short flight. However, it was the first planned leg of the day. They were going to drop off one passenger, presumably Dale Earnhardt Jr., and then go on forward to San Antonio. But it was a visual approach into the first airport. So what sort of flight plan was filed? Were they planning on doing IFR from Elizabethtown, Tennessee, over to San Antonio? They apparently were, and I did not state whether they had any kind of flight following or IFR up until the approach, because again, they could have had that and then called for a visual approach and they wouldn't have any more radar service or anything like that. But again, there's not a lot of detail in that part of the report. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of specific planning they had for those two flight legs.
You know, the other thing is this was an uncontrolled airport. They're landing on a short runway. They were diving and driving. It was obvious from when you look at all the data that the board put together. They married it up with the cockpit voice recorder. And again, you can see that these guys are trying to salvage a very bad situation that should have been abandoned well before this airplane ever got below 2,000 feet.
And another thing in the public docket, there was an analysis from the manufacturer of the flight data recorder, not only of this flight, but of a flight several months before taken by the exact same aircraft on the exact same route. And we'll be putting on the video version of this, a graphic from that report that shows the white line, which is the flight of the accident aircraft, and a blue line, which was the same aircraft 4 months before. And you don't have to be an expert to see that there was a very, very, very different flight profile. And it's obvious they had to lose a whole lot more altitude in the final phases of flight versus the non-accident flight. So it begs the question, was the same crew flying on that previous flight? Or for that matter, had this same crew even flown together before or flown together into this particular airport? Those are great questions. They were not answered.
And one of the, and I'm going to solicit an answer from you, John. There was a great quote in the report when the NTSB interviewed the co-pilot and was asked about the fact that he had the director of operations, basically his boss, sitting in the right seat. The question was, well, did his, you know, presence or his questioning have any influence on your decision making? And the pilot in command said, nope, nothing. It's like, really? So again, why is the director of flight operations, where he sees that this the whole approach and landing are going to hell in a handbasket, why isn't he directing the pilot in command? We're unstable, we're fast, we're high, we're sinking. This isn't good. Let's get out of here, go figure it out, and come back. Why wasn't that kind of discussion taking place? Why was it that, you know, as things got worse, they're going to continue to try and salvage a bad situation? And that's why I always get back to this question of what was the sense of urgency to get the airplane on the ground? Why didn't you go and do what you needed to do, come back, slow down, configure, and follow the policies and procedures that not only are within your organization, but one, are good standard operating procedures, good operational discipline, and, oh, by the way, are commensurate with the training that you would have received in flying this airplane.
Why would we revert back to that training?
I know.
Besides what we've all been taught.
Well, you know, we've always heard, you know, train the way you fly, fly the way you train. I can't imagine that this kind of approach and landing was ever trained. This kind of scenario may have been trained, and it would have been maybe evaluated as far as determining whether or not you're exercising good ADM, aeronautical decision making, to abandon the approach, you know, call it all off, abort, whatever you want to call it. And come back when you're settled and you got it under control and you're configured. And like you said, Todd, you know, when you compare it against that previous flight, it's apparent that the previous flight had all those qualities. So the question is, why didn't this flight have those same qualities?
Now, before I forget, earlier you mentioned that the standard procedure was to deploy speed brakes after touching down. They did not. However, speed brakes were deployed during this flight in an area where they shouldn't have been. According to the airplane flight manual, speed brakes can be deployed in flight, but they should be stowed before you get to 500 feet AGL. And they were so desperate to try and get this airplane lower and slower, they were deploying the speed brakes below 500 feet AGL. So we already have something where they're completely off the rails with respect to following procedures. And it didn't stop then, because obviously they weren't able to stop the aircraft. But let's fast forward to the happy part of the story. Forget about how they got there. There they are. They've come to a stop. They're on fire. With the help of the passenger, presumably Dale Earnhardt, they're able to get the door open. So that begs the question. When it comes to fractional ownership type aircraft, executive aircraft, this one did not have a flight attendant. You had the two pilots, you had the passengers. How much training or briefing should a passenger have in these kinds of Part 91 executive aircraft operations?
You bring up a very good point. And given the fact that the flight crew is required, just like you and I are required, if, you know, we take Big John flying with us in a 172, we're supposed to provide a pre-flight briefing, how the seatbelt shoulder harnesses work, how to escape from the aircraft, basically some of the obvious things. But in this case, you know, again, the pilots are only required to provide that pre-flight briefing. And a lot of them will forego that because, oh, we fly him all the time. He's on the aircraft or she's on the aircraft all the time. They know the aircraft already. Plus, the regulations don't require pre-flight briefing on multiple legs. So if you got on and you stop somewhere, but you remain on and you're going to another place, technically the crew doesn't have to give you another pre-flight briefing. Again, it's one of those things where it's always good information. We preach it all the time with passengers on commercial airliners that when you get on, you got to pay attention to the flight attendant. You should count seats. You should understand how to open up an emergency exit, how to get out of your seatbelt. And, you know, in some airplanes have a seatbelt and shoulder harness in first class and things like that, because it does not work the same way it works in your car. The fact that, you know, now you're relying on a passenger or multiple passengers to aid and assist in the evacuation of the aircraft, because there's no guarantee that one or both pilots are going to be able to get out of the cockpit, usually because the front end of the airplane is what takes the biggest hit first. It may be left up to the devices of the passengers. And in this case, you have a small child and you have an animal on board. So not only do you have to get through the fact that there's panic, stress, the airplane's on fire, so there's definitely a sense of urgency, there's smoke, there's a variety of things. You could have people go into a panic, haven't paid attention, don't know where those emergency exits multiple are, because there are multiple ways to get out of aircraft. So again, you bring up a good point, and the question is, should there be more of a requirement that if you're flying a complex aircraft or a larger aircraft, that the briefing to passengers, since there isn't a flight attendant, does it need to be more thorough, more in-depth, to the point where you go back or you're talking, well, you know, have a passenger actually identify, there's exit one, there's exit two, I know how to move that handle and get that thing open. Because again, high stress, high anxiety creates panic. It creates, you know, brain freeze and everything else. And you could have a survivable accident that could turn into a fatality for that very reason.
Now, one of the reasons this particular event is educational for the audience out there is that there was actually quite a bit more information than usually happens in an executive business jet type of situation. There was a voice recorder and the equivalent of a flight data recorder on board this aircraft. And there was an extensive analysis done by the manufacturer, which is included in the documentation we have for this. So no matter who you are, whether you're a pilot, whether you're director of operations, whether you're a passenger, if you do this kind of flying, whether in an executive aircraft or short legs or flying into a small airport that's uncontrolled and you have to take off immediately for another airport, there's a lot to pick up here. So I encourage you to look at the report and look at the other information we give you.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that really helped Dale Earnhardt Jr. is the fact that he's a race car driver, and fire is a real possibility whenever you have, you know, a race car, because you could have a fuel leak that could cause a fire, or of course, resulting in an accident that could have a post-accident fire. And I think that that helped, you know, possibly bring him into focus to evacuate that aircraft. But he is an exception, not the rule. And if you put a family on that aircraft that all they use the aircraft for is transportation, and, you know, mom or dad or both or attorneys or accountants or somebody that's not exposed to that kind of environment, you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And that's why, you know, while private flying is, you know, a great way to fly, it is convenient, it is accessible to those who can afford to do it, you still have to be an informed passenger, because you just don't know when a minor event could turn into a serious event, which could turn into possibly a fatal event if you aren't prepared.
And if I remember right, he was involved with a motor vehicle fire in his earlier years. That just gives a little more credibility to what you were just saying.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, these are the kinds of accidents where, yeah, we could dissect the pilot performance. There were a lot of questions that I would have asked this crew in a post-accident interview that, again, I don't recall seeing it in the docket, Todd, do you?
No, other than what was in the final report, I didn't see anything extensive from the pilots in the docket.
Because, I mean, how well prepared were they? We saw a similar type accident years ago involving a Gulfstream 3, where you had the director of flight operations flying with the chief pilot, shooting an approach going into Houston to go pick up ex-president Bush Sr. And they ended up crashing that airplane and both pilots were killed. And a lot of the CRM went right out the window, failed to follow procedures. Now, here you got the two authorities in the flight department flying together, which we always talk about. You put two flight instructors or two captains in the same airplane, you got a problem, because it's like, well, who's really in charge? My four stripes or your four stripes, basically. And the, you know, communication breakdown and things like that. But it was just telling that, again, you have the director of flight operations at 500 feet, just asking a question rather than making basically a decision that said, we're going around. And if the pilot in command failed to do that, then the right seat pilot, the director of flight operations, should have been in a position to push the power up, take control of the aircraft, and take affirmative action, rather than letting a bad situation get worse. And like you were talking about, you pop those speed brakes at less than 500 feet, your sink rate goes up. Well, guess what? This airplane bounced four times. How do you think it bounced four times? Because the sink rate was real high. You know, they hit the ground hard. These are the little things. It's not big things, but it's all of these little things that add up to culminate in a very bad situation that was totally avoidable, again, well before this airplane ever took off, but even at 2,000 feet above the ground, when things weren't looking as they should, and you weren't meeting your performance profile or your performance milestones, and, you know, nobody took any positive corrective action. They were just trying to salvage a bad situation.
Yeah, at what point, and when you're bouncing that hard, the initial bounce had to be pretty hard for it to continue on for three or four times. I mean, at what point do you give up with that? He still got his speed up.
Yeah.
He could have initiated a go around after the second bounce.
Yeah. And again, it's all about configuration, because, you know, the ground spoilers or the flight spoilers did come up at some point. The engines were in a reverse thrust phase, even if they were translating open or closed. So now you have an improperly configured airplane for flight. And now you're just basically a passenger hanging on, hoping for the best, because you don't have any real control. And the board talks about it in the probable cause that the pilots lost control of this aircraft. Was that in flight or on the ground? Well, it's obvious it was on the ground, but it was also in flight as well.
What were they thinking?
And again, you put people in peril, or at least in a position of peril, including yourself. And they're professional pilots. They have a lot of experience. I mean, one of the pilots, I think the director of ops, had well over 1,100 hours in this airplane, in this make and model. And the PIC had 900 and change. So, I mean, these guys were not new to this airplane. And maybe sometimes, as we know, we talk about distraction and complacency and a variety of things. We've all seen, John, and I've investigated how many accidents where you get a lot of time in an airplane, you know the airplane like the back of your hand, and you think that you can fly it out of bad situations. Why? Because been there, done that, and I know the airplane. And again, maybe that's something that really puts them in a compromising position because they think they know the airplane better than they do. So, and Todd, we've all been there as a pilot, where, yeah, we should have done something different, but for the grace of God or whoever your creator is, got you through it. And then you get off that airplane going, I'll never do that again. You can't say that about these kinds of events. You got two professional pilots that no one wanted to make an affirmative decision to, you know, abandon the approach and do the right thing.
So this is segueing into my second to last word, which I've been struggling with because there's so much to pick from here. So I'll just pick two things. One is what you mentioned before, complacency. These are two senior pilots, one of them a management pilot, yet somehow or another they made rookie-type mistakes and almost cost the lives of everyone on board. On the other hand, you had the passengers who, one or more of them, probably working together, they were able to deal with a surprise of a situation, a potentially traumatic situation, which they worked their way out of. And they were working in concert with the flight crew to escape that aircraft. So, you know, hats off to them for doing their part. So we all have a part to play, no matter what kind of plane you're flying in, even if you're a passenger.
And John, with that, we will leave you with our last word.
Well, you know, this, I'm going to deviate a little bit from my normal last word, because here we have a chartered flight, and these people, the pilots are commercially rated pilots. They're actually, the public expects the same kind of behavior from pilots at that level as they do with commercial aviation pilots. And admittedly, you know, the pilots for a major airline don't have more support than these guys do, but they're the senior management, and they're not following their own rules, which I'm sure at some point in time, they've chastised pilots that worked for them for not following the procedures, but yet they chose not to. I mean, it's really, really flies in the face of all the safety that we have taught and operated under for years and years. As you were talking through some of this, Greg, I was thinking about when you and I went flying with Bob Hoover and how professional he behaved on a private 91 flight through the procedures, just like it was a commercial aviation flight. And that's the difference between a real professional pilot and people who fly professionally, but sometimes don't even operate professionally.
And that's when it comes down to operational discipline all the time, even when nobody's looking, or you're flying with somebody that you're very comfortable with. And again, those are the kinds of things that breed that complacency or the lack of response, or definitely a challenge in response. I mean, to make the statement at 500 feet when this aircraft is smoking to the ground in a high rate of descent, and you ask the pilot in command, hey, do you think we should go around? At 500 feet, that airplane at 1,500 feet a minute is going to hit the ground in pretty short order. That is not the time to be asking, hey, think we should go around?
That was a cue. I think maybe he was giving him a cue. They're sinking too fast.
Yeah, I call it hinting and hoping. Okay, if you're going to do that, if you're going to do the hinting and hoping that, okay, I'm going to give the guy the hint and hope that he reacts, you don't do it at 500 feet.
Right. No forgiveness.
Yeah, you've just killed all your margin of safety right there. So It is difficult to understand, but again, that's why I've gone back to, there are a lot of unanswered questions I would have asked, because there could have been something in the setup before this flight that literally caused this accident sequence to occur. So, well, gents, hopefully the audience, you know, will read this report, go through the docket. You know, there's always good information. We don't have time to really get into every nitinoid detail, but there's always some good tidbits of information. And again, you know, it's all about taking things to heart. Whether you're a professional pilot or not, you have an obligation as the pilot in command, and the expectation by the people that you're flying, that you're going to make the appropriate or right decision at the right time, whether it's to salvage a bad situation, avoid a bad situation, never put yourself in that bad position, you know, whatever the case may be. There's a lot of expectation, and you have to take that responsibility. As the FAA says in 91.3, you are the pilot in command. You are responsible for the operation of that aircraft, period. No one else, just you. And again, we have to maintain that high level of operational discipline. It's like getting in your car. Again, you have your significant other, you have kids, you have the dog, you have the cat, doesn't matter. There is an expectation that when you get on the highway or drive down the street, you're going to be plugged in, paying attention, not on your phone, not distracted, not complacent, not tired, and you're going to get from point A to point B safely. Why? Because not only does your life depend on it, but the people that are sitting in that vehicle with you have an expectation that you're going to protect them with your good decision making. Enough preacher pedestal there. So, gents, I look forward to the next accident that we dissect. And as we talked about at the end of last year, new changes are coming to the show. You'll start to see them incorporated. So we look forward to having you follow us along. If you like the show, you don't like the show, send us an email. You know, again, we always appreciate input. That's how we change the show. That's how we make things better. And so we look forward to your input. And of course, if you have an accident that you think we should talk about, send it in. We'll talk about it. With that, gents, always good to see you. I will let you say goodbye, John.
I just ask everybody to please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.